tried to figure out as much as we could, but we got conned. The theater that said they would accept us, we leapt at that rather than waiting until getting a more legitimate theater.
That's Nikki Guadagni. She's been nominated for 5 Gemini Awards and won 2 for her roles in Major Crime and Blue Murder. Her one-woman show, Hooked, started as a private performance in people's homes and eventually made its way to the Fringe Festival in Edinburgh. In our podcast, we talk about acting, producing at festivals, her training at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, and of course, our lives as parents. Hey, it's Keith Tomasek. Thanks so much for listening to The Inadequate Life, a podcast about the creative process and people whose lives depend upon it, brought to you by Stratford Festival Reviews. Now, usually, if you listen, you know, I usually record this in my suburban basement spare room, but since my mother-in-law is moving in, there's a lot of change going on here. It's part of life, right? The inadequate life. So right now, check this out. I'm recording in a room. It's literally, I'm spreading out my arms on either side of me, and I can hit both walls. Hello? It's basically a storage room that all my stuff is now in while we try to figure out what we're going to do with our basement. But it's like, I love the mother-in-law. She's wonderful. She moves in later this month. Don't get me wrong. And I'll keep you filled in as to where my home office finally ends up. In the meantime, I have to say thanks for all the great feedback about the last episode with Brooke Johnson. Remember, she was talking about her relationship with Pierre Trudeau and her play Trudeau's Stories based on that relationship. Now, some listeners mentioned that despite his gentlemanly behavior towards Brooke, Trudeau only had one thing in mind. I don't know. I don't buy that, actually. All I know is that Brooke, she wrote a beautiful play about their relationship. And based on that and based on our conversation, I have no doubt that Brooke inspired Trudeau and certainly kept him intellectually stimulated. I have no doubt about that. So if you haven't heard that podcast, give it a listen. It's something to listen to, that's for sure. She talks about little Justin's breakfast routines. So before we get to my chat with Nikki, I want to thank my sponsors, Ellipsis Digital. Digital strategy for creatives by creatives. That's what you can expect from their team of strategists, creatives, and makers who help clients make connections and translate their stories in the digital space. That's Ellipsis Digital. Find them, of course, at ellipsis.digital. And my other sponsor, she's been with me since day one. She's the best. Karen Hartwick over at Stratford Tea Leaves. If you're planning to be in Stratford, book a tea tasting or just drop in to experience the world's best, freshest, and most exotic loose leaf teas with Karen Hartwick. She is Canada's tea sommelier. She travels the world, checks out the teas. I'm drinking her, what's this? It's a Canadian blend. It's a Canadian breakfast. It's like English breakfast. So it's got the little caffeine kick I need these days as I'm adjusting to the mother-in-law moving in. And I put a little lemon in there. It's really good. Anyway, visit Stratford Tea Leaves online or just drop by Stratford Tea Leaves when you're in Stratford. Okay. Time for the podcast with Nikki. Lots going on here, so settle in, get comfortable. And I don't know what part of the podcast I enjoyed the most, hearing about her youth in Montreal, where I grew up also, the creative process behind her hit show Hooked, or just how she and her husband dealt with their teenage son who spent way too much time playing video games and then online poker, and how he turned that into a career. Really interesting story there. Anyway, we start out by talking about Nikki's parents. Her father immigrated to Montreal from Italy. He was a hardworking old school engineer, but he died when Nikki was just a child. So I asked Nikki if she had a sense that he would have supported her interest in the arts.
God, no. In fact, he probably wouldn't have encouraged me to be an actor at all. I probably would have been a teacher. I don't know. We had 4 kids. I was the youngest. He'd kind of given up on me. He was, the others went into the sciences, and I remember him trying to teach the math timetable to me when I was like 6 years old, and he kind of threw up his hands in despair. So I think he knew I was artsy. My mom was a violinist, and she loved the arts, and so she... After my dad died, she became a secretary at Loyola, making $50 a week. And she saved money so that I could go to drama school in England when I was 18.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. So that explains, because a lot of, so you did, you studied at Dawson College. I studied in the theater program at John Abbott. So sort of different sides of the island there.
So you must have had Gabrielle Soskin.
Oh, that's hilarious. Yeah, of course.
Gabrielle taught me at Dawson. for the two years I was at Dawson, and we're still good friends. And she actually came to Toronto last year to see Hooked, my show.
Gabrielle was my movement teacher, and I was just trouble. Like, I was not, you know, I hadn't been doing stand-up comedy, and then I enrolled in the theater program, and I'll never forget the first day. Anyway, I was just making jokes. She really had to straighten me out, which she did. And then we became friends, and I used to do magic and sort of street performing. And years ago, I did a magic show for her little son. That was so long ago at their house.
Like, wow.
I'm talking when I was 17 years old.
Like his birthday party.
Yeah, that's what I used to do. That's right.
Yeah, Gabby, I used to come to class about 20 minutes late, so I was bad in my own way, because I used to hitchhike from the corner of Sherbrooke and Victoria, where I lived in this funky little wooden house, and I was always late. And when I got into RADA, which I have to give her credit for, because she really helped me with my audition speeches, she would say, "Nikki, RADA will not put up with you being late." And she was absolutely right, because if you were late at RADA, you know, three times you were out. So Gabrielle.
She held us to that high standard. That is so cool.
She did.
Oh, yeah. And she gives back. Like, I've just caught up with her once in a while on social media, and it seems like she has a genuine interest in helping younger people find their power and their voice in the world of theater.
And, you know, I wasn't entirely alone. I was with Richard Greenblatt.
I know. Now, Richard came on the podcast as well, for sure, and he talked about that. But you made it in. He was like he didn't quite get in his first chance. He had to work hard.
He admitted that.
He did, yeah.
Yeah, there was a really difficult time there for a month or so when I was in and he wasn't. You know, I would never have even occurred to me to audition for the British Drama Schools. But one day, Richard came into class. It may have been Gabrielle's class, actually. And he had a list that he'd got from the British Embassy of all the British Drama Schools. And I went, "Hey, could I borrow that?" And I wrote to them, too, and got an audition. And the auditions for RADA were in May. So there's somebody else who was absolutely instrumental in kicking me across the ocean and getting me into RADA.
Yeah. And what would you say, looking back at it now, what would you say if you had to identify three things that you got out of RADA, what would you say they were, honestly? Or can you even encapsulate it like that?
Okay. I'd say the Alexander Technique was a huge thing. They had the Alexander Technique probably before any of the other theater schools. They gave me, just having those four letters after my name made me feel immensely confident because, you know, you went to RADA, it's the best theater school in the world, you know, arguably.
Mm-hmm.
What else? Gosh, I got a damn good British accent, which actually was more of a problem when I came back to Canada because I didn't know how to lose it. You know, they told me if you want to work in England, which is what I decided to do, you have to use this accent all the time. It has to be second nature to you. So I basically became British, which satisfied a yearning in me because when I grew up, I really wanted to be Hayley Mills or Pamela Franklin. So here I was pretending to be Hayley Mills and Pamela Franklin. When I came back to Canada, I didn't know how to get rid of the British accent. And you know, being Montrealers, you would understand this. We grew up on American television.
Yes.
We had Channel 3 and 5. Hmm. The tragedy of my life was watching Captain Kangaroo and knowing I could never get a Schwinn bike because you had to be American, right? It was like, all I knew was I wasn't American.
No, I agree. And like you said, the NBC and the CBS feeds that we'd watch, I used to watch Merv Griffin or Captain Kangaroo.
Oh, Merv Griffin. Yeah.
I was a big variety guy back then in Montreal. And then, and first generation parents. So my English was not the first language of either of my folks. And it sounds like that was the same thing for your dad. And was your mother a Montrealer?
My mother was from Saskatchewan, actually. But her parents were British.
So your mother was probably comfortable with you going to RADA then.
Yeah.
Did she ever come out and visit you there?
Yeah, she came out and saw a show. And when I was in the West End, she came out and met Paul Scofield and that whole thing. And that was very cool.
Yeah, what a thrill.
In fact, we were doing The Tempest and Scofield, who was an astonishing actor, he tripped on his gown when he came out that night. I always remember. And in the wings later, he said, "Darn, I wanted everything to be perfect for your mother." Really sweet, you know?
That's so sweet.
Oh, he was a very wonderful, wonderful man.
Hey, Nikki, just talking about Scofield, I know I was reading a little bit about your experience watching him develop as an actor and how you could see his portrayal just moving from, you know, bare bones at the beginning to super depth. And you used a term that I found fascinating. You said that sometimes the craft of acting is like downloading people. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I got the expression from an interview I read about Meryl Streep, where somebody described her going into a room with somebody she was about to play in a movie, and she came out 2 hours later, and it was like she had downloaded the woman's character and personality. Hmm. And it's such a modern expression, downloading, right? But people instantly know what it means. You just absorb, you absorb people, and you absorb them spiritually, mentally, physically. You absorb them in all ways. And it's not just how they sound, it's an energy that they've got. And I think part of acting very much is mimicry. And sometimes I think that that's maybe what I was, pardon me, when I said I wanted to be Pamela Franklin and Hayley Mills, I mimicked them for the longest time. Maybe that's how we enter into a craft or an art, is you mimic. And
absolutely.
Then eventually you have to find who you are, who is the artist in you. I've got this wonderful, wonderful student, an actor named Matthew Govea, who was just in a show in town, and Killer Joe. He's brilliant. And he downloaded Al Pacino for years and years and years. And what better actor to download, you know, to learn from?
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got to start letting go of Al Pacino's habits and find your own.
Now, interesting though, just because you mentioned mimicry and in the same sort of section there, absorbing people's energy, which are two completely different approaches. And I noticed you're also a Reiki master. Did, when you studied the process to go through the Reiki certification and so forth, did that help you at all in terms of tuning into people, or did you already have that? And as an actor, that made it easier for you to practice the Reiki?
You know, that whole world of energy and spirit is still so, I don't even know if I can talk about it. I'm actually studying at the moment to be a Donna Eden energy medicine practitioner because it fascinates me so much. And I'm trying to find out what my gift in it is. And the Donna Eden energy medicine is sort of Reiki supercharged, or she studies Reiki and all kinds of all different energy techniques, energy systems. And Donna Eden, this woman that I study, she sees colors. Some people see auras. Some people hear voices. Some people see images. Well, I know I sense something, but I'm not quite sure how to articulate what it is. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. You're in the process of figuring it out, it sounds
yeah,
like.
Yeah, I am. I've heard that there's a wonderful Donna Eden practitioner in London, because I had a corporate client, because that's what I do on the side. I coach corporate clients, who lives in London, Ontario, and I suggested she go and have a massage. And she said she didn't go for massage. She went to a Donna Eden energy medicine person in London, and they were amazing. Hmm. So I don't know what their name is, but I'm sure you could find out.
I'll try and find it out.
It's very cool.
Now, just because you brought up the corporate side of things, I was talking to the young musician Dana Manning, who, when she was very young, had great success and was working, you know, with a record label and Tom Petty's music producer, and then decided to just, she needed a break, and she just stepped out of that world for a while. And then now she's back at it and really successful. But in the podcast, she said it was so important as an artist to be able to juggle a bunch of different mini careers all at once. And just because you mentioned the corporate training, talk a bit about that. It's my understanding you help people in terms of some of their athleticism, but their physical posture in terms of leadership and how they can use their comportment to help get their message across.
You,
is that right?
You got it. That was it. You've just said it all.
Okay.
Yeah, that's it. I have probably six mini careers. And I need all of them to, as they say, cobble together an income. And one of them is corporate coaching. And the skills I have as an actor and as a director, which means I can look at somebody and go, I think I know what you're doing physically or what you're doing vocally that's interfering with how you want to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
And it could just be the way they're holding their hands. It could be the way they're pitching their voice. And it could be their script. And so I've learned how, through the company I work for, I've learned how to coach people to do that. And I've been doing it for 20 years. And I love it.
That's so fascinating. I would never would have thought of that as taking the skill set that you have trained for and then using it to something that is potentially in a small scale, certainly a great source of revenue, you know, every now and then. Or it sounds like you've got regular clients, right?
Yes, through the company I work for. But you know, what you do is what a lot of people now in the corporate world want to find out how to do. They want to be able to communicate well on conference calls and video chats, because more and more it's virtual communication.
Well, let's talk about this, because I could use another little mini career.
Yeah,
let me tell you that, Nikki.
Absolutely. Yeah. More sidelines, please. Pay the mortgage.
That's right. Yeah, because I'm not making any money off the podcast. Unless, you know what I do? I don't actually talk about it enough, but on the website, so The Inadequate Life, there's actually a button there that says support the show. And you can donate whatever you want. Or if you donate $30, I send you some tea from my sponsor. And I got to be telling you, honest, I've only got two people, because I never talk about it. But the two people that have sent money are both from the United States, which I never would have imagined in a million years. Yeah.
Well, you know, I immediately went to iTunes and,
right.
and put you on the iTunes. So that doesn't get you any money?
Oh, no. No, there's no money in that. No.
Oh, okay, well, then I'm going to give some money.
No, you're on the show. You don't have to. Thank you very much.
but I only know about you because my daughter, Tess Benger, who's an actress, and her partner, Edmund Stapleton, who's an actor, he told me about your show.
Oh, cool. Now, Tess is at Shaw Festival, right?
Yeah, that's right. And Edmund told me about your show and how much he loves it. And he was downloading Brooke Johnson's. And then this afternoon, he came down because he lives with us. And I said, I've got to run. I've got to go have an interview with that show again. That show again. And, you know, I keep stumbling on inadequate. It's like there's so many words that come to my mind before. It's like inauthentic, inexpressible.
Oh, I see. Oh, okay.
So, inadequate. I go, yeah, inadequate.
The inadequate
and
life.
On. And he went, oh, my God, you're doing it? And so it was very cool.
That is cool. Yeah. That's good to know. Folks. Yeah. You never know. And I mean, I do have a sense of, you know, the hundreds and thousands occasionally of people that listen, but it's nice to know that people in the community are listening.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, when I listened to Brooke Johnson's, I went, if I was a young performer, well, for me, it was exciting. And not just because I'm a friend of Brooke's, because it reminds you do it because you love it. And when she said, oh, this, I quoted this, I don't think of it so much as a career. I think of it as a vocation. And because careers, in your mind, you have a picture of some kind of projection that goes up, some trajectory. And I was brought up Catholic, so vocation is a word that resonates with me. And she's absolutely right. It is a vocation. And if you think of it as a career, you're going to be sadly disappointed.
Yeah.
You know?
And you know, something that I talked to Brooke about when we didn't have a chance to get it into the podcast because we really focused on the play Trudeau Stories that she's doing. But one of the things we talked a bit about, and I think it's a similar experience that you had, was that when I met her, she was very busy as a young actress in Canada doing television and doing stage work. And then all of a sudden, when she hit a certain age, there just seemed to be less roles for her. And now I know that when you won your Dora Maver Moore Award, you had an acceptance speech and you talked about the fact that it's difficult after a certain point to get roles. Is that true?
No, absolutely. I mean, if you look at any of the scene breakdowns, any of the character breakdowns for casting, most of the roles they're trying to cast are very young. There might be a one role for somebody, a woman over 50, and you know you're going to walk into a room with 12 of the finest actresses in this country, all over 50.
Right.
And any one of you could do a brilliant job at it. And in the American television shows, they're beginning to see more and more. And Canadian television shows are usually at least 5 years behind, certainly in hairstyles, but definitely
in certainly in hairstyles. That's hilarious.
Oh, my God. Well, I remember I used to do Street Legal. I did two guest spots on Street Legal, and they were teasing my hair and you know, giving me big, big hair. And I was going, yeah, but in the States, the women are showing their roots. And
that's
and
so funny.
It's because they know they're working women. They don't have time to do this.
So, yeah, it dries up after a certain point.
Oh, my God, everything dries up.
Everything.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
No, yeah, it dries up. And so it started for me when I was about 40. And I'd had Brooke and I both had had very successful TV and film careers. And
award-winning film and TV careers.
Award-winning TV. Yeah. And you think it's going to keep going, you know, And then there's less and less auditions.
So, but it's at times like that when we're sort of going through these transitions, when we realize the power that we have. And something that I love is the fact that you sort of got this play Hooked, which has done so well for you. And now you're actually producing it. It's your own. You're running the show, correct?
Well, I'm running the show with a lot of help. My producer, Christine McLean, Lane Coleman, the director. When I started out, when I was doing house shows, we did about 40 house shows. I had Janet Burke as my producer.
So just to back up there, sorry to interrupt. Mm-hmm. A house show is where you're actually literally performing the piece in a house, which I think is a great idea.
Yeah. So I'll tell you the... I'll tell you a history of it as briefly as I can. Lane Coleman, the brilliant director, was living in a farmhouse on Highway 2, Napanee. And I went up there for 3 days, and with this copy of Hooked I had that my wonderful friend Carolyn Smart had written. And while Lane was writing his book in one room, I was going around different rooms in the farmhouse and rehearsing different ladies. And then I would...
So the play is about
Go
ahead.
Yeah. So the play is seven women, all mostly early 20th century women. There were three Brits, Unity Mitford, who was part of Hitler's entourage, and Myra Hindley, who was the Carla Homolka of her day in Manchester in the early 60s, and Dora Carrington, who was a brilliant painter, who was... on the fringes of the Bloomsbury group. Then there was three Americans, Jane Bowles, known as Paul Bowles' wife, but also a brilliant writer, Carson McCullers, and Zelda Fitzgerald, and one Canadian, Elizabeth Smart. And these seven women, Carolyn Smart, the writer, had chosen to write about, and she read everything she could that they had written and was written about them. And then she sat down and wrote these astonishing poems. And they're so brilliant, and they work so well as monologues. And they're so different than a kind of monologue that a playwright would sit down and write in a linear fashion, because she's a poet.
Mm-hmm.
And so the challenge with it was following the wonderful leaps of imagination and the liberties that poets take with language and metaphor. So it was a great, great challenge, as challenging for me as Shakespeare. And I've been doing it for 7 years, and it always continues to challenge me. You know, I'll still come across metaphors and I'll go, you know, I really haven't mined that yet properly. So at the end of these 3 days, and Lane would come in and to each room that I was working in, and I would do it for him, and he would say, that's brilliant, that's wonderful. The end of the 3 days, he said, let's invite a dozen people up from Toronto at the last weekend of this summer, the last weekend I'm going to be living in this rented farmhouse. Sandy Belkovsky will come and cook. And Sandy Belkovsky is a wonderful theater director who used to be at Second City. And she will cook for this weekend. And we had such great people, Linda Griffiths, who was my great friend, Maggie Hushlack, and John Blackwood, and Chaz Lowther, and Gail Kerbel, and Carolyn Smart, and her writer husband, Kenneth DeCock, and Jim Gerard. It was a wonderful, wonderful group of artists. And for 3 days, we ate amazing food. Sandy is an incredible cook. And we took walks, and we drank, and we caroused, and we sang. And then every so often, Lane would say, please come into the parlor and meet Unity Mitford. And everybody would sit around and listen to this monologue. And then Sandy would cook things appropriate to the next character. So when we invited everybody to the basement cellar to meet Myra Hindley, she fortified everybody with a bloody Myra. You know, it was amazing. And so we got this idea, because it was so successful and everyone had such a good time, what if we did this in people's homes? So over the next 4 years, we did about 40 different homes. And Janet Burke, who was one of the people there, was very keen to help me in any way she could, because she loved the show so much. And Janet Burke and Sandy and I would arrive at people's homes and We would set up their home. We would go choose seven different locations for seven different women, and Sandy would cook. And the show lasted about 3 hours, 3 or 4 hours, and the audience would move from room to room, and in between they would be treated to a Bloody Myra or moussaka or whatever dish that Sandy concocted in relation to the next character.
It's so bizarre to me. Sorry to interrupt, but there's a sort of a weird, because these women, I mean, obviously they're very passionate, but they're, I don't know what's the word, are they deviant? How do you define them? But to have those characters in your home, that must have been sort of strange.
I know. I mean, people were very freaked out about Myra Hindley. But the wonderful thing is, because Sandy is so funny, she would introduce the next character, but giving people the food appropriate to that character. And she would say silly things about them. And they would laugh. And somehow Sandy's humor would choose to kind of cleanse their palate.
So which of the characters was the most heinous that required the most sort of setup from Sandy?
Myra Hindley, definitely. I mean, she murdered 5 or 6 children. Unity Mitford was right up there, too. One was the most hated woman in England. One was the most despised woman in England. But Unity is terribly funny at the same time. Hmm. So she's a little easier to take than Myra Hindley.
So the show grew from there. Now, I know at one point it ended up at the Edinburgh Fringe, which is such an accomplishment to take a show there.
Yes. God, it's difficult. Yes. We kind of ran out of people who we knew who were well off enough to invite us into their homes. Because, you know, it was like $125 a person because you got the show.
And the food.
Food, and you got the booze, and you got, it was a big deal. And we don't know that many people who can afford that. So I thought, you know, I still want to keep doing the show, so I'm going to make a theatrical version. So Lane and I worked for many months on making it into a theater version that I could just stand up on a stage and do it. Brought it to Edinburgh, that's crazy. So you've done Edinburgh?
No,
right?
I've done the local fringe scene, and I've got a dear friend in Edinburgh. He's actually in New Zealand now, but he kept on inviting me, but I was never able to get out there. But two questions, and how many performances did you do, and were you able actually to cover your cost, or was it a loss at the end of the day?
Oh, no, it was a huge loss. It was a huge loss. You know, at the same time as I was there, Alain Nashman was there with his show, John Hirsch, and Derek Chua was there with Hayley McGee's one-woman show. And these guys had already done The Fringe, both of them, twice. And this was their third time. And you could see in their eyes, they were absolutely determined to figure out how this thing works,
right?
Theater. And Christine and I, my producer, we tried to figure out as much as we could, but we got conned. The theater that said they would accept us, we leapt at that rather than waiting until getting a more legitimate theater. Mm. And they said the 10:30 p.m. slot is one of our best. And it was, of course, the worst slot.
Oh, wow.
But we did have wonderful accommodations, so that made up for a lot of things.
And I saw some reviews. You got some great reviews, yes, which is huge.
Yes.
The Times, you know?
Yes, yes. About a week and a half before we left for Edinburgh, the one thing we didn't have in place was a publicity person. So my husband emailed Alan Rickman, who was a great friend of mine, and we were at RADA together.
Okay.
As Richard Greenblatt, we were all mates. And
oh, my goodness.
Just wondering if you knew somebody who would do publicity. And so Alan said, oh, yes, you could try so-and-so. And we found this wonderful woman. And she agreed to take us on, probably because Alan Rickman
said, yes.
You know, it really, I swear, you know, what I have learned at this ripe old age finally, and wish I'd known much earlier, was it really is who you know. So much of it. And it's not, I don't mean...
No, you still have to have the work. At the end of the day, you have to have the work. Put the work in.
Keep up your friends, you know? Learn to chat to people nicely and well in opening nights. I was always a get out of there as quickly as possible kind of a person, just because I'm shy.
Yeah, I'm sort of a similar way, actually. I prefer a one-on-one like this than a sort of a group and that whole sort of thing. Yeah.
Yes, completely. So yeah, she got us the Times, and she got me BBC and BBC Radio. So that was very helpful. But you know, it's a zoo. It's crazy. I mean, Alain Nashman really had it down. He would thrust a postcard, because that's the thing, you've got to have all these postcards, in people's hands,
right,
and go look them in the eye and say, "Do you like Downton Abbey?" And they'd go, "Yeah." And then he'd say, "Do you like Maggie Smith?" And they'd go, "Yeah." And he'd say, Maggie Smith loved my show. And he'd give them the postcard, and it had a quote from Maggie Smith, because Maggie Smith came to see Hirsch when he was doing it in Stratford.
Of course,
and it was so
of course.
Smart, right? Yeah. And you've got to have this kind of... My husband was brilliant at it.
Yeah, no, when I did The Fringe with a friend, Gary Yates, who's a film director now, we were exceptionally good at... we actually... got into some trouble. We were so aggressive with our promotions, and we were there. It was crazy. We were the first ones to duct tape posters to the actual concrete. We did all kinds of things. We covered up a one way sign because our show Something Strange fit perfectly right over the sign. And the beauty of that was, it was left. It was right in Edmonton near White Avenue there. And then in wintertime, the Edmonton Journal took a photo because it still said Something Strange, and there was all this snow. It was such a beautiful photo of our right. of our little homage or little memory of our show. Hey, but here's another thing I want to ask. Was Fringe Festival is one thing we have in common. Another thing we have in common. No, we're getting away from the play though.
That's okay.
Yeah. So we're both parents, except I've got a little 9-year-old, and I'm fascinated. About it sounds like you've got some kids that are in the arts and some that aren't. Is that right?
Yes. I've got two actors and one a poker commentator.
Okay. No, I read about your son. This is what I learned. He was a Counter-Strike, okay. which is a video game, a champion Counter-Strike player, where he'd earned 25 to 30,000 at a tournament, and then switched over to becoming a professional poker player. Who's won millions. Now, that doesn't mean he has millions, because you have to win and lose. But as a parent, when did you think to yourself, there's something going on there? That must have been so bizarre.
Oh, it was. You know, I was looking at photographs just a couple of days ago of my children. And at around the age of 13, my lovely son started to gain weight and become obsessed with playing computer games, because 13 is really hard for boys, and girls are very confident and can just break their hearts. And I think that happened to him. And so he retreated into that. And it was very, very difficult for my husband and I, so difficult that my husband made a wonderful, wonderful documentary called First Person Shooter, which is a story about computer games and our son. And it was very hard because we didn't understand. Now, the fact was, our son was brilliant at what he was doing, but he didn't know how to explain that to us. You know, he beat everybody in Counter-Strike in Toronto, and then he beat everybody in the province, and then he beat everybody in the country, and then he beat everybody in North America.
And this is as a young teenager?
Yeah, this is when he's like 16 or 17, and we were just going, yeah, but you may be playing Counter-Strike at 2 a.m. with somebody in Belgium, but you've got a 9 o'clock class at Jarvis Collegiate, you know, which you're going to sleep through. So it was very hard. We just wanted him to graduate from high school.
Yeah.
So hence Rob and Benjamin, my husband, made this documentary, First Person Shooter. And then Griffin parlayed his talents into poker, because of course what you learn from computer gaming is how to have very, very long stints, you know, how to stay sharp for 12-14 hours.
Sure, that's right. That's right.
Online poker. Yeah. And you need to be able to make decisions and have confidence in yourself and be very driven and very competitive, which Griffin had always been since he was a kid. He was a great, great sportsman. Now he's a poker commentator for the new Global Poker League. And he is, he's not an actor, but my God, he should be. He's a brilliant commentator.
Well, and just to be a poker player, you have to be an actor, just so people don't recognize, you know, as soon as you look at those winning. And I watched him.
Yes.
I watched him win an amazing hand on Shark Cage, the Shark Cage champion.
Yes, Shark Cage, where he won against Mike Tindall.
Unbelievable stuff. So going back to the parent thing, what was the turning point? Because, I mean, my guy's not that – he's still young enough so that everything's okay. Nothing is that intense.
Oh, I was thinking about – he's 9, right?
Yeah,
that's
so
– stage, yeah.
Yeah, we're okay. Nothing is super intense. But when it's that intense as a young teenager, how – talk about the transition from you and your husband being concerned about it to recognizing this is something that is he's actually skilled at and that could be valuable for his future.
I don't know if that's ever really happened. Well,
how old is he now?
He's just turned 31.
Oh, so he's yes, okay. So I wonder if I would ask him, when did his parents realize that he was going to be okay or was making a living? What? Because a lot of the young people ask, they say, oh, when I got on TV, that's when my parents knew I would be okay, which is sort of funny.
Well, you know, it's a bit like an actor friend of yours saying, hey, I've got a TV series or I've got a great film gig. And they look like, and this is going to last forever.
Right.
And you want to go, this is not going to last forever.
Yeah.
You know, buy a house, do something.
You get a couple of years out of it if you're lucky. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and so poker and computer gaming, similar, right? But now he seems to have a career as a broadcaster, which is a little more stable.
And then one of your other kids is, did you say also in one of them's in theater, you said?
Yes. Yes. Tess Benjamin.
All right. Of course. It's Shaw. Yeah.
Is at Shaw, and this is her third year at Shaw, and she's at the moment ecstatic about singing Stephen Sondheim. She does that really, really high note in Sweeney Todd that makes people's ears prick up.
I'm so excited to go see that production, too.
Oh, me too. I mean, she was practicing that note this morning in the attic, and it's astonishing. She's amazing. She always reminds me of what I never had at her age in terms of self-confidence and drive and competitiveness in a way. You know, I would walk into rooms full of actors and go, boy, anybody here should get this part in front of me. And she walks into rooms full of actors and she goes, not her, not her, not
That's her. That's hilarious. Yeah, I'm more like you. I have that may, I don't know what it is, but I have that more let live and let live vibe.
It's hard to make a living with that kind of attitude.
So those are both unusual career, but not unusual, but, you know, career paths that as a parent, it's not necessarily your first choice because like you said, it's not teaching what your dad might've had you do.
No, for some reason they never got into the sciences and, my son, 22-year-old Charlie, he's also an actor.
Oh my goodness, wow.
Yeah. And, wonderful actor, so much more talented than I was at that age, and understands TV, has no interest in theater whatsoever, probably being dragged to too many shows when he was a kid.
That's what we're doing with Cole. I think we're going to drive it out of him. I hope not, but who knows?
You know, this morning you and I had a brief chat before this interview this afternoon, and you said, you reminded me that you had a 9-year-old son, and if I had any words of wisdom, and I thought about it a lot today about what my words of wisdom would be. And it was keep your sense of humor. And I didn't have one. I'm only sort of rediscovering my sense of humor now because it is difficult being an actor, being an artist, and cobbling together 5 different jobs and also remembering that to tell the babysitter that the dinner's in the freezer and get to rehearsal on time. And I always felt my mothering suffered and my acting suffered because I was trying to juggle these 2 vocations. And if I'd been able to keep my sense of humor more, I think I would have enjoyed things a lot more. Does that make sense?
It does. It totally does. Except for me as a parent, it's almost the opposite in that we have too much fun and I just don't think there's enough discipline going on.
No such thing as too much fun.
Oh my gosh. The other night we were driving home from a basketball game. So we were about 4 minutes away from the house of his friends. I was taking his friends home in the back of the car. And my kid just started riffing about the game and, you know, imitating the sports announcers. And then he took a break for the commercials and he's making these. And literally, it was probably 4 minutes. And I'm trying to hold back the laughs because he makes me laugh too often. And I just thought I have to find a way to channel this. So we're doing 2 things. Well, I'd like to get him in improv for kids because then there's at least some structure and some discipline and he can work in a group. You know, he's an only child. But we're working on a musical called... My wife always tells me not to say this publicly because she thinks it's such a good idea. A family musical called What Rhymes with Poo.
Oh, nice.
Because nice. He's at that
My
age.
My mind just went do, coo, boo.
Oh,
yeah.
I know. It never ends. But the kids, like, he's still obsessed with farts and poo and all that stuff. And I'm starting to say, okay, look, let's actually write something. Because he every now and then comes up with funny jokes or lines. And let's just start writing these things down. You never know where it'll end up, but...
But, you know, I think the improv thing is great. I was taking a course last year. I took about 4 improv classes with Kate Ashby, who's a great, great improv teacher. But she's also very disciplined.
Hmm.
Kate Ashby would say things about, and some of the best acting notes, make the other person more important than you are. And that sense of kindness and care and empathy. And that goes back to the energy work, you know, that we talked about earlier, is really figuring out how you're being perceived. And are you being perceived the way you want to be perceived? Are you communicating clearly? Watch somebody's face, eyes, listen to their breath. That is, I have learned so much through doing Hooked in people's homes. I had to be a better actor than I was, because on stage you can hide.
I bet.
And you can't when people are 2 feet away from you. They can watch you breathe. And the commitment is very strong between you, because I can see if they reach down and take a piece of lint off their knee, and they can watch any time, any break in concentration in me. So it was a huge demand on me, but it really made me into a much more honest, authentic actor.
And now, so the you're doing Hooked at the SpringWorks Festival in Stratford. Anywhere else in the next little while as well?
No, you know, this might be the end of it.
Well, don't say that.
Well, it may be. I mean, that would be a shame. But, you know, if any of your listeners want to invite Sandy and Janet and I to their house,
oh, yeah,
we would
dinner.
Be more than happy to do the house shows. We love doing the house shows. Janet, Sandy, and I love hanging out together. And it really is a great evening if somebody is wanting to have a slightly off the wall, invite their friends over.
That sounds like it. Now, where's the best place for someone to get in touch with you if they wanted to do that?
On the website, Hooked in House, Hooked the Play. We'll take you to the website, and you know, maybe I'll some theater across the country will invite me to come out and do it there. But the wonderful thing is that I don't get bored with Hooked.
Well, those women just sound like they have such fascinating and compelling lives. I can't wait to see it.
Absolutely. Oh, I hope you get to see it.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
That would be great, yeah.
Well, Nikki, thanks so much for taking the time today to do this. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I loved it. It was so much fun. Thanks.
You're very kind. And wow, I'll get out to see the play in Stratford, and then yeah, and then I'll watch. Oh, and I'll get to see your daughter over at the Shaw Festival.
Yeah,
going to be amazing.
Yeah, and you can watch my son, Griffin Benger, on the Global Poker League.
On the Global Poker League, yeah.
Yes, it's called Twitch TV.
Amazing. And then your young guy, 22 years old, we'll watch for him coming up. What's his name?
Charlie Benger.
Charlie, okay. You guys are busy. Charlie. Hey, and that documentary, is it available? You talked about the documentary, First Person Shooter. And if a parent has a concern about the amount of video games their kid is playing, is that something to see?
Yes, definitely.
And is that available online?
Yes. You can just Google First Person Shooter. My husband's company is Cogent Benger Productions, and it should be fairly easy to find.
And who knew that we would have had Gabrielle Soskin way back in Montreal Uncommon?
We must tell her to listen to this broadcast.
Yes, we will.
She'll be chuffed.
Thanks so much, Nikki.
Okay, you're so welcome. Bye.
Well, there you go, Nikki Guadagni. Go see Hooked in Stratford, or just visit their webpage, Hooked the Play, for more details. Anyway, I'll have all the links from our chat on the show notes at theinadequatelife.com. So just visit theinadequatelife.com for all the links. In the show, Nikki kindly mentioned she was going to throw some dollars my way to help support the podcast, which I appreciate. And just in case you're interested in doing that, I did mention I was a street performer. And back then I closed each show by reminding people to drop a few bills in the old hat. You can do that digitally at theinadequatelife.com. Just visit theinadequatelife.com and click support the show, little button there. And you can throw in whatever you like. If you throw in $30, I'll send you via Canada Post some tea from Karen Hartwick over at Stratford Tea Leaves. That's theinadequatelife.com. Support the show. And I have to remind you, I accept American money at par. There you go. I try to put out a podcast at least twice a month. The next episode, it's a good one. They're all good, but it's a good one. Rebecca Northen. She talks about how she turned her one-woman improv show into a North American tour with the support of the guy who produced the Tony Award-winning show you might have heard of, Avenue Q. It's a great episode. It's coming up next time. Don't miss a single episode. Just subscribe on iTunes. It's super easy. Search the iTunes store for The Inadequate Life and then hit subscribe. That way, you'll never miss an episode. That's visit The Inadequate Life on the iTunes store and hit subscribe. The Inadequate Life, a podcast about the creative process and people whose lives depend upon it. I'm Keith Tomasek. Thanks for listening.